Welcome to a new episode of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler, and today is Monday, May 9th. This week, we kick off the first of a three-part podcast series focused on colorectal cancer. Dr. Tanios Bakay-Saab, a GI medical oncologist at the Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, leads a great discussion with Dr. Kristen Siamber, a GI medical oncologist and associate professor of medicine at Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center, and Dr. John Strickler, a GI medical oncologist, associate professor of medicine, and co-leader of the Molecular Tumor Board at Duke University School of Medicine. This conversation focuses on the current molecular treatment landscape of advanced colorectal cancer and the need for the Colomate platform. Among other things, our experts detail this platform and expand on its impact for patients, as well as the evolving world of colorectal cancer treatment. Take a listen to this discussion and make sure to join us next week for part two of this fascinating conversation.
You know, the world has changed quite a bit for us in colorectal cancer. I mean, I recall up to 2012, all what we cared about is KRAS and exon 2, and it was a negative predictive biomarker. So how did we evolve? You know, and I have been quite jealous of lung cancer and breast cancer, and you know, they subtyped and subgrouped and went after targets, and you know, we spend the longest time arguing about FOLFOX and FOLFIRI and BEVA and all this. And now we're in a different world. So maybe, you know, give us your high level view about, you know, how you saw that evolve over the last 10 years, and what does that mean to our treatment, our care for our patients now, and then, you know, how does that integrate into research?
Yeah, I think when you look back at how far we've come in the last decade or so, I think it's pretty remarkable to see the differences and the changes that have come in the treatment of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. You know, we've had the backbone cytotoxic chemotherapies and some of the biologics for a while, but really until pretty recently, when the technology was really developed to not only test tissue but test blood for circulating tumor DNA, we could finally identify potential actionable targets, much like in other tumor types as well, which has really been done in parallel. And then not only identify actionable targets, but also start to understand why tumors are resistant to particular targeted therapies and how we can overcome both primary and acquired resistance. So, you know, you're right, the RAS, KRAS story was really, we've typically thought about that as a negative predictive biomarker, but now with the advent of some KRAS G12C inhibitors, it's starting to be a positive predictive biomarker as well, which is really, really encouraging. You know, and one other thing that I would say is that, you know, we initially were thinking as we would identify these actionable targets that many of them were, you know, certainly not RAS, but others, HER2, BRAF, were pretty low in prevalence. But when you think about colorectal cancer being so many people being affected by it, those numbers add up. So it really makes a lot of sense. And we really need to be testing for certain certain actionable alterations. So at the very least, RAS, BRAF, HER2, MSI, et cetera. But I would argue that there are a lot of emerging targets now. So now our next generation sequencing has become really key to understanding what treatment options are available for our patients.
So Dr. Strickler, John, how do we integrate this knowledge into the day-to-day practice before we move on to the question of how do we enhance our research?
Well, this has been one of the primary challenges as we've entered into this era of precision cancer medicine, is that, you know, we're all ordering these tests for our patients. We're all incorporating it into our care as best we can. But what we've found is that there are some gaps that are still there. So specifically, when we get these reports, they oftentimes live in our on our hard drives as PDFs. Sometimes they're scanned into the medical record. They're hard to access. It's hard to remember who has what. Something becomes actionable and you can't remember the 200 patients you just profiled to know which of the 200 might have that actionable biomarker. And what the result of that is we have historically enrolled poorly onto biomarker related trials and have failed to capture the benefit of precision medicine. So that's what brings about the need for Colimate. We know that we have these actionable biomarkers, but we need the data to be actionable in real time. So when the patient's in front of us, we can more quickly convert that molecular profiling report into an enrollment onto a trial that helps push the field forward. So I think that's really what Colimate is trying to accomplish, is real-time clinical trial support to help our providers match our patients with the right trials at the right point in time in their care.
So, Kristen, describe a little bit, to the audience, what is Colimate? What is that structure?
Yeah, so Colimate, which stands for Colorectal Cancer and Liquid Biopsy Screening Protocol for Molecularly Assigned Therapy, so it's a mouthful, which is why we call it Colimate, is an umbrella screening protocol that is open at many sites across the U.S., and patients who have metastatic colorectal cancer, who have had most of the sort of standard cytotoxic chemotherapies, are eligible to enroll, and they undergo molecular profiling using the Guardant 360 assay. And then the investigator then receives the information or the sequencing back. And not only does the investigator receive that information, but actually the Colimate screening committee actually gets that information as well and can help make recommendations as to next treatment options. So this is really goes a step further, I think, than individual physicians ordering molecular testing. The other nice thing about it is that many times, we do see some financial toxicity from some of the molecular testing and some of these additional tests. And this is a really great way for a patient to have serial molecular testing at no cost to them, which is really wonderful. And then from the testing perspective, then it really opens up the possibilities for enrollment on one of the companion trials that is part of the Colimate screening protocol. So it kind of funnels patients to appropriate trials that are target driven, so genomically directed therapeutic trials.
Hey, that's an interesting. So Colimate is an umbrella type of trial with a little bit of a platform. So John, what are the advantages of having these umbrella trials?
Well, there's a number of advantages to this type of umbrella format. I think the greatest advantage is that when you order that test, even though each trial may be looking at an individual rare biomarker, when you combine trials together, you can raise that hit rate. So Colimate is designed to have at least 25% of patients screened match for a companion trial out of Colimate. And that means that it's worth our while to do this testing, because we know that at least a quarter, if not a third of our patients are going to match to a companion study. Additionally, another major highlight of Colimate is that we have worked on rapid turnaround time. So one of the limiting factors, and this has been found from our Japanese colleagues, which we'll discuss some of their works shortly, but they found that having a short time gap between when you order the test and get a trial recommendation is critical to improving the actionability and improving enrollment on studies. So that's another major advantage. We also, because we as the investigators determine which studies will be companion studies from Colimate, we know that our patients are being assigned to highly active therapies. And this is a wonderful open source model of data sharing, where we have individual investigators designing many of these studies. And then we've also been able to collaborate with our industry partners as well for them to bring in innovative concepts that leverage this screening this screening study, Colimate. So we've been able to take advantage of the scale to help find patients for rare targets, but also help generate innovative findings.
The testing fatigue, the rare target testing fatigue. And I always think about how frustrating this can be for, you know, the both the physician and the patient, you know, to continue to test and say, well, I'm sorry, let's, after waiting a little while, let's move on to the next option. How do you view these types of umbrella platforms or umbrella platform studies, you know, helping solve some of the issues that are real, you know, for those rare target studies? And you've run quite a few of those.
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge. And what I think is really going to help us overcome that, and it has already started to, is seeing that we can utilize the information, that it's not just information that is not actionable. So for instance, you know, one of the big stories over the last few years has been this concept of the anti-EGFR rechallenge. So seeing that subclones can develop, RAS subclones and others, in patients who were previously RAS wild type and treated with cetuximab or panitumumab, they may actually be eligible for rechallenging with anti-EGFR therapies if those subclones go away. So just even seeing how, even outside of a clinical trial, though we do have good clinical trials in this space as well, Dr. Strickler is running polls through Accrue, but being able to actually utilize the serial testing and have it be actionable is what's really key. And we're starting to learn that these resistance mechanisms are potentially actionable. And it's not just information, academic knowledge that we serially test these patients for their molecular alterations, but we can really make a difference in their outcomes.
Yeah, thank you. John, I'll let you finish on this one. So what are the advantages of using these so-called liquid biopsies? But also, what are the disadvantages at this stage, and what does the future hold?
Well, I think the advantages outweigh the disadvantages in most cases. The major advantage of the so-called liquid biopsy is that it's very convenient. So if you decide you want to run the test, it's merely collecting tubes of blood in your office that day. You don't need to do an invasive biopsy. You don't need to track down tissue from an outside hospital. So, and obviously painless for the patient, except for the blood draw. So very convenient and quick. The turnaround time for a liquid biopsy is much faster than in most cases, a tissue biopsy and getting a similar panel. Additionally, there are some advantages in terms of what I call getting a democratic representation of what's going on with that cancer. So when you do a biopsy of a tumor lesion, you are only sampling the spot where that needle went. But when you get a so-called liquid biopsy, you're collecting all the circulating tumor DNA that's secreted from all the tumor lesions in that person's body. And it allows you to get a fuller picture of all the potential mutations, both the dominant mutations and even subclonal mutations. And that's particularly important when you're dealing with issues around acquired resistance. So one of the things we've learned over the years is that when patients progress on targeted therapies like anti-EGFR antibodies, they will sometimes develop not just one alteration, they'll develop multiple. And you can see all of those alterations at one time with the so-called liquid biopsy. So when you're looking at understanding mechanisms of resistance, in some ways, a liquid biopsy is superior to a tissue biopsy because you get a fuller picture of what's going on. There are some disadvantages with the liquid biopsy too. I think the most obvious one is that we're less accustomed to getting these reports back. So there is a bit of a learning curve for a physician to look at that report and understand what the alterations mean. I think also there can be some confusion about what to do with these, what we call subclonal mutations. meaning they're not present in tumor tissue. There may be a present in lower quantity elsewhere in the body, and we don't always know how to handle those. So those are just some of the disadvantages. But as I said, I think when you become accustomed to reading the reports and understanding clinical context, the advantages far outweigh the disadvantages.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or just listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information and to stay up to date on all the news and notes in the world of oncology, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.